queen of primetime. A little bit old school here. We see that Roseanne herself finds herself the queen yet again as she is rebooting her show with huge reviews and listenership throughout the week. I am Tim Ray Millington. That is Chris Mueller. You're listening to Trending.
Yeah, that's been a bit of a surprise. I don't think anybody saw Roseanne crushing the ratings in the way it has. And I think what people are reading into it is that this is a family. This is a story about a family of people we recognize, right? These are people who live next door to us. They're not perfect and polished and beautiful. You know, they're normal people dealing with normal stuff.
Well, I just look at the numbers, Chris. 13.5 million television sets were actually watching the show on Tuesday night. And that was actually down from the prior first 2 weeks of its reboot. And just compare the numbers. Fox New Girl has 2.1 million in comparison to the next highest before Roseanne is 7.7. And that's The Voice. More of a family-friendly show, right?
Right.
Well, Roseanne seems to be pulling a wider audience.
Yeah, I think this is, you know, I think what people are hoping for is sitcoms you can watch as a family, right? And I know there's a lot of sitcoms I go, wow, that's hysterically funny, and I can't watch it with my kids because they're pushing an agenda here, and I just don't want to ingest that into my life. I think people are looking at Roseanne and they're remembering this series in the 90s, and they're thinking, gosh, I hope this is a good family show that deals with things we want to watch and laugh about.
So I popped on a couple of episodes. What's nice is that they are short, 20 to 30 minutes range there. But what I thought was interesting is, you know, the premise of the story, the kids have moved back into the parents' house and they bring their children. So the grandchildren are there. You know, you have, you know, one child who's gone through a divorce and is considering in vitro fertilization to make some money. Another kid who's come back from the war, I believe fighting in Iraq. And you have this aunt who they're all upset with, and it gets into a lot of politicization of who's voted for who in the past elections. And I just am really surprised, actually, that it's become so popular, but there's such a political element to the entire show.
Yeah, I wonder if there isn't a bit of a Trump bump here.
Yes, there's definitely a bit of a Trump bump in the show for sure. You know, you see a little bit more of the conservative elements. It actually reminds me in some ways, as you see Last Man Standing pulled off the network last year, and then you see Roseanne, it actually reminds me of that show in many ways.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. Harkening back to a time before me, we look at like All in the Family, you know, the Archie Bunker thing, which was very similar. It was almost the set was very similar too in the color scheme of the film. But they dealt with the political issues of the time that people were struggling with. And, you know, obviously Archie Bunker was kind of a stereotype of that conservative. His kids were more part of the hippie movement and that thing. And are we seeing a similar thing with Roseanne, where we're seeing the things that we're dealing with as families, where we're trying to come to grips with this rapidly changing culture, and then you've got kind of an anchor here saying, I'm not going to move, like I sit where I sit, and that, I guess that's kind of the Trump bump part of this. You know, is this just kind of a rehash, and should we have seen it coming? Maybe.
Well, and maybe it's making people laugh who are struggling with their own family members who are on polar opposite sides of the political spectrum at a time when, man, I mean, a lot of family members just have to avoid any conversation about the weather today because it turns into an argument.
Yeah, and wouldn't it be great if this show could just role model civil discussion between different people on different sides of the aisle?
Total civil discussion. If you watched any of the shows, not really happening.
Well,
but
I haven't watched the show, so I'll admit.
I'm just throwing it out there. It's entertaining for sure, but definitely, you know, you see people name calling and frustration, and you see that frustration come to life, but in a comedic way.
But let me tell you, civil discussion, one thing, but there's discussion. It's happening in the context of family. It's happening in people who are getting angry at each other and yelling at each other, but love each other in a familial way.
That is a fantastic point. And I think that is something that I saw taking place a little bit, maybe trying to understand where the person was coming from. It was definitely an interesting kick. I think that it'll be neat to see where the show goes. And I think maybe people feel more comfortable where some of like the more explicit content, even if it is in vitro fertilization, you know, young kids aren't going to get what that means necessarily. They're just going to understand something about baby and pregnancy.
Right.
And, you know, definitely wouldn't necessarily recommend it for a kid show, but I think more families are probably gravitating toward the show because they think it is a little more family friendly.
Yeah. And I'm absolutely far from giving an endorsement because the reality is we've got, well, like a couple episodes here. And one of the writers has come out and said, this is Whitney Cummings, saying that the series is going to upset, and I'm paraphrasing what she said, a lot of conservatives like that as they go on. So just because the first couple episodes look good, this is anything we're doing, entertainment in our homes, we have to, not be in a defensive posture, but we have to be in a critical thinking posture and listening actively so that our children, our families aren't just absorbing the stuff that's happening in front of us and we're just laughing, not paying attention that, whoa, this is veered off from where I thought it was going.
You know, one thing I find interesting about some of the shows that try to push more of a conservative feel to it is that they try to make the assumption in the show that even though the person's conservative, they're still pro-women's rights. So in other words, actually pro-abortion, destroying little women's rights, right? And they're also still pro-contraception. But in reality, you talk to a lot of people who do hold a conservative value, their views on sex are actually quite different most of the time. And that's why, you know, I'm not saying 100%, but that's what is frustrating. You do have a show that might be, you know, whether or not we're conservative or liberal, whatever you want to say. I just think it's interesting that a group that demographically tend to be more pro-life, they're claiming is not pro-life on TV.
Right. Oh, yeah. It's the sanitization of conservatives. Oh, no, it's just economics. It's just policy. But they're really social liberals. Right. And so these people are the good conservatives because they're social liberals.
Right.
Right. And that's how we make it acceptable.
Social economic liberals. And man, just the pieces of it. It'll be cool to see what happens. Another topic, though, looking at what's happening in our church pews, fewer butts are in the pew.
Yeah. I mean, and okay, so this is not, I don't think this is revelatory. We've seen multiple studies that have come out along these ways to say that younger people are drifting from the church. But yeah, we're definitely seeing, you know, less and less young people in the church. And I think we're kind of approaching historic lows.
Well, when you look at the biggest dip in church attendance that we had seen back in from 1950 to 1970, in 1950, nearly 75% of people were going to church once a week, right? That Sunday mass, Sunday best, you know, Sunday, some sort of church obligation on Sunday. Well, you fast forward to 1970, only 50% are attending. Now you fast forward to today, we're seeing that 39%, specifically Catholics, report attending a church within the last 7 days. You know, and you look at these numbers, Chris, and while we see a decline continuing to happen and people can go, oh, all hope is lost, we're no longer a Christian nation. Well, we are still a Christian nation in many ways, and many people unfortunately have maybe left Catholicism or identifying more with evangelical or Protestant churches. We can look at this. And what can, I think at the end of the day, we say, I think that we need to work more on personal invitation to church and not just some social media post about the Catholic Church.
No, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, I actually had posted on my Twitter account, if someone had attended your parish or a Catholic church for the first time this weekend at your parish, what would their impression have been? You know, and would they have felt welcome? Would they have felt like, would their experience of Mass been something transcendent or something bland? Right. Mm-hmm. And again, that's not me saying about one specific style of worship, or I don't want to get into that argument, but it can never be bland, right? There's right. The Mass can never be bland. It can never be ordinary. It can never be just something we do every weekend. This is not some weak reenactment. We're entering into the sacred mystery, right? We're entering into Christ's sacrifice and then receiving him in his body, his blood, his soul and divinity. It's something I have to push myself to say, no, engage, you know, and lead my family in that. But then, yeah, that spirit of welcome. The kiss of peace shouldn't be a disingenuous just thing we do.
Mm. Yeah. Well, and I think we often have the attitude where we just are Catholic, we do Catholic, but we aren't actually Catholic. It's more so the idea, oh, I have to go to Mass on Sunday. Mm. We have to go to Mass, so what time are we going to go to that is most convenient for us? Or is our Sunday centering around that day of rest? Or more so centering around church comes first, and now, hey, we've got the day free, right? Like, that's the attitude we should be having, but we're not. But I think about it, we have to go to Mass. No, we get to go to Mass. And say, you know, you just mentioned engaging. What can we do to try and engage? God has offered us the graces to be there. I sometimes think about Our Lady, Chris, and how God offered prevenient graces to Our Lady. So instead of allowing her to fall into that hole of sin, he covered that hole up. He never allowed her to go there, right? She wasn't born with original sin.
Right.
Us, yes, while we may fall into that hole of sin, God is still offering us too prevenient graces, preventing us from falling into sin. Well, maybe we can ask for those. I remember this incredible monk not too long ago looked at me and a number of people at a retreat and said, hey, have you ever thought that when you enter into prayer, asking for a spiritual gift from God, maybe you pray for that gift of concentration. Maybe you pray for that gift of understanding what is said today in prayer and Mass. You know, are we going into it and actually saying, I am weak. I am frail. I have the inability to focus. Please help me focus here.
You know, I want to get back to what you said a second ago, too, about that mindset of Sunday obligation. You know, the Mass is a wedding feast. We're the bride. He's the groom. The Mass is the most intimate reception of the Lord we can have. Can you imagine now, in the context of your marriage, you said, well, I'm going to go complete my obligation about the most intimate reception of your spouse you can have. Ain't nobody want that, right? Like,
right.
And so this, when we come to Mass, it's a total giving of self. It's not an obligation. It's an opportunity. It's a celebration, right? And we need to come with that change of mindset that, no, this isn't something I have to do. This is something I get to do. It's something I'm invited to do. It's where I encounter the beloved and be the beloved.
Right. Well, and I think, too, where's a moment in the Mass where maybe we can recheck in at a time we often tune out? The offertory, right? Where the gifts are being taken up and presented to the altar. That is you. Everything you do. Your struggles, your joys, your relationships, your children, your family members. You are taking everything you do. And I have to tell you guys, listeners or anyone I speak to, when that takes place at Mass, I think I'm offering you every person I've spoken to this week. I'm offering you every little bit of financial struggle I might have. Oh gosh, I got to finish my taxes. You know, everything I have, you know, we're offering it on the altar right now because our offering on the altar is united to the offering of the priest of what will be transformed into the body, blood, soul, and divinity of Jesus Christ that we will then consume. We are being united to him.
Yeah, absolutely. I got a lot to say on this because I'm a dad. I've got, you know, six kids and there's a certain amount of going to Mass in my vocation. We're kind of coming up against a break here, so probably gonna have to get that on the other side of this. Timmery, where can people find you on social media?
People can find me at Timmery. That is Timmerie. We will be right back on Trending with Chris Mueller and Timmery Millington. You're listening to Trending. This is Timmery Millington. My co-host Chris Mueller is here, and we were just talking about that moment at Mass when you are offering up during the offertory, when the gifts are being taken up, you are uniting your offering, your sacrifice, your children, everything that you experience. Maybe you, the listeners, we offer up. That is your moment.
Yeah, you know, I think there's this change of mindset in going to Mass to prepare yourself for that moment. If I'm preparing to have a romantic, intimate evening with my spouse, and again, the church is the bride, Christ is the bridegroom, I'm going to prepare myself for that. I'm going to shower. I'm going to dress nice. I'm going to make a plan. I'm going to be ready for the evening and to go out with my wife, right? Am I preparing myself to go to Mass by getting into the liturgy of the word ahead of time? Maybe you have a gifted preacher at your parish. Maybe you don't. We're so good at blaming other people for why I wasn't involved at Mass. But the liturgy is right there online at the Catholic Bishop's website, usccb.org. You can read those readings ahead of time and prepare your heart to receive the word at Mass. You can make a good confession or an act of contrition if you're not in a state of sin to prepare your heart to receive the Lord in the Eucharist, right? There's things that you can do. Now, I understand if you're a young family like myself and you've got, you know, basically you're wrestling a naked chimpanzee the whole time, that can be very frustrating. You go, I didn't get anything out of Mass this Sunday. And I hear that from people all the time. I didn't get anything out of Mass. Remember, Mass is a total giving. You're giving yourself. Christ is totally giving himself to you. And the other thing is, no, you lived out your vocation. You brought your children to the Lord. You role modeled the importance of this. And so when you're wrestling with your child, don't get frustrated about I'm not getting out or my kids are being disruptive. Enter into prayer to whatever degree you can as you squeeze your child like a python trying to get them into submission. When we sing the songs, if I love the music or hate the music, I'm going to sing the music. Why? Yeah. Because it's my opportunity to give praise to God in the context of the Mass. And I want my children to witness that.
Even those moments when it's difficult to sing along at the tone the choir is singing at, you're like, I can't really sing, so maybe I'll just say the words out loud because it's difficult. It doesn't matter.
Right.
Doesn't matter.
I remember my dad leaning over to me and saying, if you don't know the words, just hum.
Oh, that's
right?
Sweet. Yeah.
And you can offer that as worship. Or, yeah. You know, when the readings are in Liturgy of the Word, lean over to your child and whisper, go, did you understand what that was?
Yeah.
You know, did you hear that? Or, you know, little parts of teaching the Mass. Lord, I'm not worried that you should enter under my roof, but only say the word and my soul shall be healed. Did you know that comes from the Bible and this is the centurion and reminding your kids the story and all those good things. Like as parents, like our vocation can be lived out in Mass a different way and the frustration can end. And then you can get the enrichment of I'm leading my children into this.
Right. And I think that the issue is that you mentioned this a minute ago. we basically go looking for what we can get out of it. And someone was challenging me recently at a talk I went to. It was a priest, Father John Therese, and he said, you do not go to Mass to be a consumer. You're not a consumer, but all of us for some reason go, well, I like this church and the way it looks. I like the people who show up. I like, you know, the comfortableness of the pew or how the kneelers are. I like what this specific priest says, so I only go to this priest. He goes, you go to Mass to be consumed. You do not go to be a consumer. And if you guys think about that for a second, you go to Mass to be consumed. So how are you allowing yourself to be consumed? Maybe, you know, Chris, you just mentioned some great things like how do we prepare? How do we pray? Maybe there are some specific prayers that we ourselves bring to the Mass, whether it's when we kneel for those few minutes before Mass to pray, offering up all the prayers of intercession for a specific person. Today I offer my Mass for this particular friend of mine. Maybe it's offered for, you know, a family member. Or maybe after you come back from communion, you're sitting there and you say the words of St. Paul, it's no longer I who live, but you who lives in me. Find your own prayer in the midst of all the prayers that are taking place.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the prayer of a desperate father, Lord, I believe, help me in my unbelief. You know, I mean, how often do we pray that at Mass when I'm having a hard time seeing God? Lord, I believe, help me in my unbelief. And God wants to honor those prayers. Absolutely.
You know, as we talk about Mass, we struggle with just paying attention. We struggle with being present. We struggle with seeing what is right in front of us in the glorious mystery. But at the same time, we are looking at one of the most difficult topics in our culture. And we can't even tune in to this topic of the gender issue. We just say, hey, it's confusing. I'm just going to say, okay, anything goes, and sit there passively. Well, we're sitting passively at Mass a lot of the time. Well, here we are in the midst of the transgender issue, and we're just saying, okay, that works.
Timmy, I've got to congratulate you. That was a great transition. I had no idea how you're going to get there from there, but well done.
Blunt transitions. I wonder why is he giggling next to me right
now? Empty
pews
to transgenderism. It was well done. Anyway.
Well, getting to the point, you know, total awkward transition now. An endocrinologist studied this really popular book. I'm sure you are aware of Jazz Jenning, who wrote the book I Am Jazz. Jazz is actually one of the youngest documented people where there's been a big fight to allow him to participate in female sports, female restrooms, you know, school activities, whatever it might be. But Jazz, he wrote a book talking about his identity as a female. Well, this endocrinologist, who, in case you don't know, is someone who studies and works with hormones, actually reviewed the book, looking at it for scientific, psychological accuracy and how that impacts, you know, a young person who might be reading it, because it's a children's book.
Yeah, you know, so the idea of transgenderism, you know, and there's a couple points in the book where the author leads you to believe that he was diagnosed with transgenderism. He wasn't. He was diagnosed with gender dysphoria, right? Mm. And that's a real thing. Like, there are certain people who deal with this disorder, and we'll call it what it is, like this condition, gender dysphoria. And that's got to be a struggle. And I like, you know, that the author of this article says, you know, people who deal with this deserve our compassion and deserve to be treated with dignity and kindness, just like all other children. And if someone's dealing with this, that's a tremendous cross, right? Mm-hmm. But the reality is that most young children who deal with gender dysphoria, when the onset of the hormones come in puberty, things tend to work themselves out. Why? Because now you've got the male hormones and testosterone, you've got the female hormones, right, that are coming in, and all of a sudden all the systems come online. Part of the reason I think, and we've talked about in this past shows, I think that kids are dealing with this, we're seeing it pop up, is we're sexualizing children when they're not at a point that they should be sexualized, right? They're little boys, they're little girls, but they're not at a sexual state in their life, right? And so when testosterone kicks in and you start developing as a man or as a woman, then it tends to work itself out. When a little boy wants to put on his mom's high heels, it doesn't mean he's a woman. It means he's a little kid who's just playing, right? Or if he says, I don't feel like a man. Well, okay, you're a little boy. You're in a different state than a man.
Right. Well, what about when he feels like he's Spider-Man? I remember my brother.
Totally.
He, talk about offertory. This is a great way to tie it. I should have tied it in this way. He is asked to take up the gifts for Mass. And this is a time where we could not get him out of his Spider-Man suit. And so
fantastic.
We could not get him out of it. It was a struggle. My mom finally puts her hands up and goes, okay, you're wearing your Spider-Man suit to Mass. That's fine. Well, they decide, you know, we're going to Mass. Well, this week, it's a week or so later, and he ends up putting on his normal clothes. He really liked to dress up. He's got his nice little suit on. And it was a fight trying to get him out of the Spider-Man suit. So he's, thank God he changed that day, right? So we take him up. We're walking down the, he's walking down the pew, and the priest decides to ask him, oh, honey, what's your name? And he looks at me and goes, Peter Parker.
That's awesome.
Do not give up the identity. I think that he wholeheartedly at the time believed he was Spider-Man. He believed that he could fly and he wanted to practice all of these stunts. If he was 12 and 13 years old and still thinking that, well, we might want to offer him some help. And in fact, we actually do. Psychiatrists work with patients who have dysphoria about different things, whether they think that they're missing a leg, but they actually have that leg, whether they think they're a 50-year-old man, but they're a 12-year-old little girl. We would be working in psychology to help that person. But instead, you know, we are looking at these young children, this little boy, Jazz Jennings, and just saying, okay, it's okay. You can now identify as a female. You can now have a surgery that is going to block the hormones that prevent you from going through puberty, and then a surgery to cut off your male parts and now reconstruct this false version of your parts to look like a lady. But Chris, is anyone talking about the fact that because the child is young, that they're not going to have enough skin as they grow to actually have a quote unquote vagina later on, a fake vagina, like it won't fit. And so then they have to have another surgery that's actually not good for them that now reconstructs into that area. And, you know, now they have to have something that is placed in the false cervix, right, to hold it open, because since that child is not actually a female but is a male and they've created this fake area, they have to have something in there constantly dilating it and holding it open.
Yeah, the idea, none of this is possible, right? None of this is possible without massive intervention, right? Mm. And to say, no, this is who I naturally am. No, it's not. And it's funny because I feel like sometimes the same people who are like pushing this are the same like organic vegetable crowd, right? It's like you're non-GMO. Like, I don't want genetically modified vegetables, but
I eat,
you know,
organic vegetables. What are you trying to say?
I'm judging you. That's what's happening. No, but does that make sense? Like, we're all so concerned with all of these things that are unnatural and not right. And then in the same respect, we're saying pump them full of as many hormones as you can at like young ages so they don't develop naturally, and cut them open and create artificial, you know, genitals on them. And that's natural. That's who they're supposed to be. It's such a tremendous contradiction, you know, not to, okay. And then you go and you look at like the outcomes, the long-term outcomes, right? The suicide rates, the depression rates, the, you know, we know that this isn't healthy for young people.
Yeah. This is Trending. That is Chris Mueller. I am Tim Marie Millington. We'll be right back. Maybe you're listening to the show and you have a thought that you would like to share, or a topic that you would like to hear on Trending with Chris Mueller and Tim Ray Millington. That is us. You can tweet us. Where can people tweet you, Chris?
They can tweet me at C Mueller Tweets. It's M-U-E-L-L-E-R Tweets.
And you can find me at T-I-M-M-E-R-I-E. That's at Tim Ray. And we're also, you know, on Facebook, Instagram. Always love to share those fun photos on Instagram, and also to really hear what your thoughts are on Twitter. I think both of us really do interact with those who are reaching out, asking questions, even if it takes us a little while to respond back. It eventually happens. But before, we were talking about the topic of transgenderism, and we're in particular talking about how this endocrinologist observed and looked at Jazz Jennings' book for young children called I Am Jazz, that is basically pushing transgenderism. And what it says in the book is, it says at one point, this little boy says, well, I may basically have boy parts, but my brain is female. Well, the endocrinologist, before she even gets into some of the hormone elements, she talks about the DNA and how if we look at the DNA, we can look at the chromosomes in the body and understand whether or not we are genetically male or female, right? So a woman, XX genes, for a man, XY. Why? Well, those male or female genes are actually throughout our entire body. There isn't a part of our body that doesn't have this very clear distinction of whether or not we are male or female. It's not just the anatomy, right? It's not just the private areas of the body that conceal this, but it's in our whole body. So when she says, I have a girl brain, that's not possible. The DNA is very clear and it's written through the whole body, the brain included.
Yeah, you even go further than that, too. So they've done twin studies where you're looking at two people who are identically. They're genetically identical, you know, identical twins. And when you have a transgender twin, you don't have two transgender twins. If it was right. A genetic thing, you would have, if one was, both would be, because they would both have been born that way because they're genetically identical. That's not the case the majority of the time.
So just to be clear, what he's saying is that's debunking the born that way myth that often people claim.
Yeah, there's definitely, you know, the nature versus nurture argument. Is this the way I was made or is this the way I was kind of bred to be or formed, you know, led to be, I guess. I think twin studies point out to the fact that this isn't a genetic thing. This is more nurture, or something's happened in your environment that has led you to choose this or feel this way, as opposed to genetically I'm programmed this way.
Right. Or maybe it's just the cross that you're carrying, right? Maybe we don't understand yet what fully the explanation is, although most of the people who struggle with same-sex attraction and gender dysphoria have had some type of things happen. I think of the case of Walt Heyer, who he himself, an older man who for a number of years lived his life as Laura. And at the time, before he considered, when he was, you know, a young man deciding to have this sex change, no one looked at him and said, is there an element of mental illness taking place for you in your life? Instead, they had the sex change for him. He then, you know, received hormones that would prevent him from ever being able to have children, ever be able to reverse the damage, right, of having that sex change. Well, what ends up happening is he ends up sharing that he was never treated for mental illness. And decades later, he's diagnosed with a dissociative disorder. They recognize that he has substance abuse issues. They recognize that he was actually abused as a child.
Yeah, I think we, you know, the question of intervention, right? If someone's dealing with gender dysphoria, what's the right intervention? And right now, what our modern society is saying, the intervention is to treat them as a transgender person. And that's the answer. It's a Band-Aid, right? And we don't deal with what's the underlying question. And so, again, you know, I think it just seems to be more sense that if twin studies show that you're not genetically this way, that the intervention would be to then help you to accept who you are and to live a healthy life in that context. It's harder work. I mean, it seems like harder work. But the reality is you look at outcomes for people who are transgendered, and the outcomes aren't that great. So maybe it's actually not harder work. Maybe it's just, you know, short-term harder, but long-term better. And I just don't think we've studied this enough. There just aren't enough studies on what's happening. And we're testing ideology out on kids. And that's just, it's unconscionable.
That's child abuse.
Well, yeah, absolutely.
We have to call it for what it is. And in fact, many pediatricians are referring to this puberty blocking hormones that prevent that child from ever, if we create the puberty blocking hormones and then start giving them the opposite hormones for what they would like to be, this identify with the sex as, that prevents them from ever being able to have children down the road. That is life-changing, life-alteringly damaging. And I think that, you know, Jazz Jennings was not old enough to understand this, even though they say that they talked about it and it's something that she understood and she was sad about when she went through her sex change. I don't think any 12, 11, 13-year-old, even 15-year-old fully understands the impact.
No, I mean, you can't. And again, I hit this point a couple times, but let the child go through natural puberty. See what happens. Like, right, that is the body doing an intervention of sorts. And if you get through natural puberty and you still feel like you don't fit, then I think you do an intervention to treat the situation. I'm not saying you transgender the person, but you deal with it. But the majority of these cases are going to shake out in puberty, right? Because you have gender hormones coming in.
9 out of 10 of those cases, actually, Chris, especially with little boys, 9 out of 10 of the cases where the little boy is experiencing gender dysphoria, which in fact, it's a little more common with boys, something that we need to look at more. And I think that there are some thoughts on this as well that we're seeing coming out. But little boys, 9 out of 10 of them, when they go through puberty, they come into adulthood, they don't end up having this issue. And part of that is that we have to recognize that the hormones that develop in the body also develop the brain. And so when a child goes prepubescently through hormone blockers, what happens is that actually is blocking some of the development of their brain as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, this idea that you can just say, we're going to take a 10-year-old and make him a woman or make him a man, it just doesn't work. You know, we're dealing with a lot of hormone questions here, and I think that just segues really well into the next topic here. They're developing a once-a-day pill for men, a birth control pill for men. And the only way that you can do that with women or men is you jack with their hormones. That's the only way that you can stop someone's fertility. You know, I think it's something we need to take a look at and discuss and say, well, is this healthy or is it not?
Well, and we look at the topic, you know, for years, women have been taking pills that would lead them to have many consequences, both mentally and physically, as a result of the pill. You put those hormones into the body, well, it prevents the brain from functioning well. It causes anxiety. It causes depression. Well, guess what? In this case study where they say this male birth control pill is showing promise, men, actually, you guys report the same things.
Yeah, it's interesting. The eight out of the 10 in this trial reported abnormally low libido.
Well, okay. That's not something you guys want.
No, I guess it's effective as birth control if you're not no desire for any sort of interaction, then yes.
Well, and they end up showing in a lot of cases like this. I did not read this for this particular instance, but I know there was another form of male birth control that was being developed, and it was causing erectile dysfunctions as well, which we already see that happening enough right now in this society. So that's definitely one way to kill the lovemaking from
happening.
Again,
if you ain't functional, ain't no babies happening.
So. You know, I just find it so ironic that you have all of these Viagra commercials and things on television for older men, right? And now slowly you've seen the pictures of younger and younger men in those commercials. Well, what's the cause of this? Why are young men, in fact, 20-year-olds, having erectile dysfunctions today? Well, they're showing in part it's due to overlooking at pornography and masturbation. It causes issues to perform when you're meant to perform then.
Yeah, at the ED porn link is something we definitely, you know, it needs to be brought to light, because what you're doing is you're hardwiring your system to only react to stimulus on a screen, right? And so you, when you're in the presence of a real person, you have so much anxiety about being with a person because you don't understand what human interaction is, right? That's the thing. And you've literally rerouted your reward response system to be set off by the screen. And so when you're with a real person, then that doesn't function. Things don't do what they're supposed to do. Again, you've jacked up the hormone process.
Absolutely. Well, and these aren't the only things that are impacting men with this new test model of male birth control. They're experiencing some bloating, some weight gain. They're experiencing, and this is a big one, the lowering of good HDL cholesterol, which is something that's very important for our health. And, you know, men are being offered up as the sacrificial victims here. Well, you guys hear these symptoms. You hear this drug that's coming onto the market. This is a conversation we were having 40, 50 plus years ago with hormonal contraception, but people didn't want to listen. And we care enough about the men in our society that we don't want them to have the mental, emotional, psychological, physical health impact that birth control has already caused for many women.
Right. And it's interesting, too. We know that taking testosterone, as a supplement, is not good for men. Like, if you take too much testosterone, it causes a whole bunch of problems. This pill, what it does is it shuts off your natural testosterone production in another hormone, and you need testosterone, right? So there's a balance that has to be in the body, and it's going to be a little bit different for every guy because different sizes, different makeups, all those things. And so it shuts off your natural testosterone production, and then they have to supplement it with the pill. So your pill, you're getting two chemicals, right, to replace that. And again, you're getting a pill that's been created to serve a plurality of men, right? You're prescribing it. And so getting that testosterone level right, that's just a crapshoot.
Right. And we don't know what the long-term use is. Even the study tested a small number of men. And even then, although for some of them, you know, their hormone levels balanced back out after a period of time off of the drug, we don't know the long-term consequences. And today we are seeing the long-term consequences for women of many decades of use of hormonal contraception. You know, a 13-year-old is put on the pill for whatever reason, whether, you know, it could be a number of reasons. 35-year-old now, they don't want to be on the pill. They want to have a child. Well, their body's been in a production of either pseudo pregnancy or preventing their body from ever being able to get to the point of pregnancy, that the body's working in a rhythm and is going to have a difficult time being able to have that child later on. You're listening to Trending. I'm here with Chris Mueller and this is Tim Ray Millington. We will be right back. In the meantime, check us out on social media. Gaudete et Exultate is the latest apostolic letter from Pope Francis. He has basically reached out and he's saying, let's talk about Christian witness in the modern world.
Yeah, I'm so glad that you said the name, not me, because my Latin is no bueno. That's Spanish for y'all.
I was almost really cruel and said, hey, Chris, introduce, go. But I didn't do that. So this letter, Chris, is, I think, brings some really great practical points, bringing us into how do we live Christian witness in the modern day world.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I've mentioned this a couple of times. I'm reading Cardinal Newman on Development of Doctrine. Great, great book. And he talks about the Pope as being the, his unique diocese is the church. It's mm-hmm. the church. And I think what we see in Francis is he really speaks like a bishop to his diocese. His diocese is the church. Now, really, the bishop is the Bishop of Rome, but we also know that Peter, the seat of Peter, he's over the whole church. And so there's a very pastoral tone in the way he speaks. It's very practical. It's something that I've read a lot of church documents, and you can tell they're talking to the hierarchy of the church. When you read this document, it's very clear he's talking to us.
Interesting. I still felt kind of like it was the hierarchy as well. I think it's a balance.
I think them too, I get both.
I felt like it was definitely he was talking to Catholics who are very involved. This isn't something, you know, and I think that it's not something where someone who's not really practicing their faith, that they would pick this up and it like really play super deeply into their life necessarily. And I think that it's always a good reminder for us, you know, even when we're evangelizing, they're not ready for the meat necessarily of deep, in-depth apostolic exhortations, right? But we can give them pieces to help them chew on it. And one of the things in particular, Chris, that stood out is when he was talking about media and technologies in some ways, and how basically we as Christians are called to be on this Christian journey and recognize that we don't just have missions, particular missions that we do, but our whole life is a mission. And in that, he talks about media and how sometimes we can allow these medias not only to distract us, but essentially make us resent or regret our mission. So maybe we're stuck watching that, you know, one more episode of Netflix in the middle of the night, preventing us from sleeping, right? And we need sleep to be on top of the work we have to do during the day, whether it's family, basic work, evangelization, whatever it might be. But this idea that, you know, our technology is what is our rest rather than true rest. And our technology sometimes is what pulls us from actually appreciating and walking toward our mission.
Yeah, I know at one point he actually talks about the civility of discussion online as well, you know, and that there's this tendency online. And when he's talking about blessed are the peacemakers, right? Because mm-hmm. He goes through the Beatitudes and he really gives the Beatitudes as, the, you know, this is how we know how we move toward holiness. And he's talking about blessed are the peacemakers. And he talks about this, the state of violence that's in our culture mm-hmm. and how that's exhibited in that dialogue online and the our tendency to, you know, factionalize, right? Mm-hmm. And all of that is just presenting your brother, your sister as other. Right. And it gives mm-hmm. us permission then to treat people terribly. And it happens within the church. It happens within the church that we're all baptized believers in Jesus Christ. We're members of the Catholic Church. We're brothers and sisters. But oh, no, you're one of those kind of Catholics, or mm-hmm. you're one of those, or you're one of the. And then you'll read message boards and the internet trolls are just, you know, for whatever faction they belong to. There's no family dialogue happening there.
That's Chris Mueller. I am Timmy Millington. You're listening to Trending. Chris is, you know, you're talking about, I think what this document does challenge is that we're not, you know, creating this division, but we're creating this true witness in the moment. that we don't just look at the other person as an enemy. We don't look at this person, you know, he talks at one point about, you know, looking down on people as I have all the knowledge and you're not living according to this knowledge. Or people who have this Pelagianist type of feel where they think that everything they do will be what saves them, and they forget the grace and mercy of God that's constantly making it so that they do good, right? It's moving them forward. It's not they themselves. It's that you're cooperating with God's grace.
Yeah, you know, I love, there's a line he says, and I'm paraphrasing because I didn't get the quote out, but he says, Christianity can be studied, but it's meant to be lived, right? And so it's a beautiful thing to study the faith, to know the faith, to know the church councils, to know the all the rubrics and all those things. It's beautiful. But ultimately, we're supposed to live out from a relationship with God in the church. Like, we're supposed to live that out. It's not just something academic. It's not just something that's abstract. It's not principles. It's living the love of God to your neighbor. And he hits that repeatedly, you know, living out mercy to other people. He talks about the tendency to see a homeless person as an inconvenience or at worst refuse, right? But what we should see is an image and likeness of God. What we should see is an encounter with Jesus when we encounter them. So whether that means, you know, how do we best reach out and witness and serve and love that person, that's a question up for the debate. But we shouldn't just ignore them. We can never ignore them. Mm-hmm. And so whether that's to give a homeless person a blanket or just a kind word, we as Christians have to share the love of God. We can't just say, well, they're inconvenienced, they're a problem, it's something for the government to deal with. No, that's not the posture of a Christian.
Right. Well, and it makes me think of how we were talking about empty church pews earlier. And one of the conversations that always comes up when we talk about the emptiness of the churches, right, at times is, well, are we welcoming people? Are we inviting them in? How do we do that? Well, everyone's different. And one of the things that Pope Francis emphasizes is this idea of being authentically yourself in the midst of your whole life is a mission, not just one thing you do to go and feed the poor, not just the moment you go and stand in front of that abortion clinic, but you're always pro-life. When you run into someone who's struggling in a crisis pregnancy, you talk to them there too, not just if you were in front of the clinic and see a girl walking into the abortion clinic. You know, you are living, your whole life is encompassed by the mission to be a follower of Christ. And so that balance of, yeah, part of our life is that formation and prayer and taking that time to grow and be, at times there is a balance of being alone in prayer, but there's also a balance of going out and influencing and loving the people you're with.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, if there's anything I can characterize this document, it is that. And again, this has kind of been a theme, I think, of this Pope, is that the church that we see in Acts of the Apostles, the church that we see in the epistles, that's us. And we've mentioned that, right? Like that's us. They're not supposed to have these, we're not supposed to look at them and go, oh, that's historic. That's a heroic time, but we're in modern times. It's different. Mm-hmm. We're called to live a heroic faith, you know, not for our own glory, not out of a sense of, I want to be a superhero, I want to be recognized, but I want to love like Jesus loved. And I wanted, and doing so, there's a heroic faith. And that's something that people are drawn to. It's something that people want to be a part of. And so, you know, this document's written, I think, to the church. It's written to people who are involved in church. It's you, it's me, it's you, the listener here. It's people who are doing more than just showing up on Sunday. And it's a challenge to us to get out of our comfort, mm-hmm. to remember that we're not Sunday Catholics. We're everyday Catholics. That's who we have to be.
Right. And I look at the opening, it says, rejoice and be glad. Well, that's pulled right from the Beatitudes. And it's talking right after it talks about you will be persecuted, right? They will revile you. They will hate you at moments. And that moment of, we're supposed to be that joy and light in the culture the entire time. And when you talk about the early church, Chris, I think of those moments where we read in sacred scripture, the apostles, the disciples are traveling from town to town, city to city, interacting with one person after another, sharing the gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ. And if someone doesn't accept it, they move on. They don't sit here saying, oh, I'm a martyr. They move on to somewhere where they will accept it, where they will be hospitable. Even if maybe they're not interested, they're open and they're willing to have a conversation.
Yeah, you know, and I love to talk about the youthfulness of that first generation, because I think it illustrates the passion we're supposed to have now. You know, the average life expectancy at the time of the apostles was around 35 years old. We know that the brain develops in such a way that up until 25, 26, you tend to think from the passionate center of the brain. So you have young people who have found the truth, And then they say, I'm going to go serve the truth. And they don't think about things like insurance policies or what if I offend somebody or what if, because it's that doesn't matter. I'm going to go love. And it's and the Pope points out, they enjoyed favor with all people because they treated everyone like Christ, right? But there was a zeal of youthfulness in that church that even though I'm 42 or you may be 65 or how old you are, there's a youthfulness to the faith that says, I'm going to go out and share the gospel. I mean, the Pope says, let us ask the Lord for the grace not to hesitate when the Spirit calls us to take a step forward. Let us ask for the apostolic courage to share the gospel with others and to stop trying to make our Christian life a museum of memories. In every situation, may the Holy Spirit cause us to contemplate history in the light of the risen Jesus. In this way, the church will not stand still, but constantly welcome the Lord's surprises. And I think there's that spirit of youthfulness, of joy that has to come out, that we have to go out and share that faith in risky, kind of exciting ways and be prepared to be surprised by what God is doing.
Yeah. Well, and I think that the Christian journey, that Christian witness does draw us into the mystery of Christ. It draws us into waters unknown. It draws us to actually discover new talents. Maybe you're someone who says, I don't know where I'm supposed to be helping in the church and society. Sometimes it's a matter of looking out and seeing where is help needed. Where is the help needed in my own soul? Where do I need to work more on my prayer life? How can I create a better routine of going to confession? You know, Christian witness starts with ourselves and how we're living our life. That is Chris Mueller. I am Timmerie Millington. You can tweet us at TimMerie. That's at Timmerie and at Chris Mueller at C Mueller Tweets. We will talk to you guys next week.